Do you think life is simpler after you retire? For some, it's actually more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors and an open forum for older adults with important questions about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome to another episode of Elder Talk. I should warn you that this week I'm flying solo, but that's okay. I think that the topics we're going to talk about today, you will find useful. You can let me know that. Please feel free to follow up on the website and elsewhere. We want feedback from you guys. We want to know what you're thinking. Are the topics that we're talking about of interest to you, or are they boring? Or, you know, tell us what you think. Our purpose here is to be of help to you and hopefully entertain you along the way. So what I want to do this week is to talk about some fundamentals and do it in perhaps a little different way than you've heard before, if you've heard any of this before, so that you will walk away having a better idea about what is it exactly that you need to have in place to feel some sense of confidence about your future. Now, I'm making an assumption in our discussion today. I'm making an assumption that if you're listening to this show, that you're probably standing at the threshold or you're in the last third of your life. So that means there's a lot of critical stuff that needs to be in place, that needs to be going on during that period of time to assure that those are the best years of your life. And certainly we can agree that it has been your expectation, as it is most people's expectation, that during the first third of their lives, they work very hard. They're perhaps starting a family. They're starting their careers. They're accumulating wealth in the second third. They're focusing and planning on that time when they retire, and they maybe do things that don't generate money, or maybe they do generate money, but it's less in amount, or perhaps it's less reliable. But nonetheless, they're in a position to kind of do the things they want to do and be driven less by the concern for income that is associated with those first two-thirds of their lives. But that makes a big assumption. It makes the assumption that during the last third of your life, you're going to be healthy, that you're going to have sufficient funds to meet your needs, that you've thought about long-term care. Big issue these days. And it's a moving target. We see that prices for long-term care continue to go up, in part not so much because of sheer inflation, but because we have new products and we have new technology, new capabilities. So these things generally cost more. And that means that whenever we're trying to plan for that last third of our lives, we have to sort of speculate about what are these costs going to be and how do I cover them? We know that some of you will have in place some sort of long-term care insurance. That is a good thing. However, I'll tell you that many of those companies have gone out of business. I can tell you the industry is shrinking. We're down to, last I checked, one or two companies that are nationally providing this product. The fact that this product exists for some parent companies, such as GE, it jeopardizes the very future of this grand institution among American businesses. GE, who would have thought, you know, the place where Jack Welch held court and was so successful, that here you'd have this company struggling for its survival. But among the reasons, and there are several, but among the reasons that it's struggling for survival is that they acquired a subsidiary that focused on selling long-term care insurance. And they're having to escrow or book these future losses. And there's some big argument about, well, how many hundreds of millions or billions of dollars are we talking about here that need to be booked and reflected in the financial statements so the prospective investors and current investors can know what lies ahead for the company. And there's a lot of guesswork there. It depends on longevity, et cetera. But I can tell you that for the most part, we tend to think of longevity as a good thing. But from GE's standpoint, longevity in a nursing home or some other facility that requires long-term care and hence probably, what, $15,000 a month in expenses, that's a pretty scary thing. So the bottom line is when you buy long-term care insurance, you need to be sure, of course, it's a AAA-rated company. You need to be sure that it's expressed in terms of a cost of a living adjustment. It's common to have a fixed digit in which you have these numbers that could turn out to represent something of virtually no practical value in the future if there's any double-digit inflation or even significant single-digit inflation in the near future. And I do expect, and I think most experts expect inflation to return, but right now we're struggling to achieve 2% inflation, apparently. So whenever you're buying things such as long-term care insurance, it's very easy to get lulled into a false sense of security. It's called the recency bias, in which you conclude that, oh, I've not seen any inflation recently, and it may mean that you define your world as what's happened in the last 5 to 10 years. And so you say, yeah, this sounds like a great price for this product. But in reality, inflation, history teaches us, it comes, and even though it may go away for a while, it sooner or later, and probably sooner, comes roaring back. And so whenever you're buying products such as long-term care insurance, you need to be sure that you have benefits that are expressed in terms of a number that adjusts for inflation. Anyway, so that's an important component of a plan for this last third of your life. Anyone who fails to consider these potential expenses fail to think about what could be the single largest, most disruptive element in the retirement plan. So you've got to think about this. Now, I will tell you that insurance obviously is not the only way to handle this. Some people will try to cover it by way of what's called self-insurance. Self-insurance simply means that you figure, okay, I'm going to assume the actuarial risk of my life, of my health. In other words, you're a risk pool of one, which means very high risk. But you've read the statistics. You know that the average stay in long-term care for people now above age 65, according to our most recent statistics, and these are always changing, is about 2.9 years. So you may figure, all right, so as long as I have, approximately 32, 33 months of potential expenses saved up, if I can afford to pay, what might that be? Well, in today's dollars, it could easily be $10,000, depending on whether you're rural, urban, the level of luxury that you may want in this facility. But let's assume that it's modest, it's in an urban area. Today's dollars, you're probably looking around, what, $330,000? $330,000 is a lot of money to have ready and handy to pay for potential long-term care insurance. And remember, though, you're betting on that actuarial statistic. Now, incidentally, you could end up on the south side of that number, which means that you actually perhaps have no costs. What if you don't spend any time in long-term care? You know, some people are gamblers by nature, some by necessity at this stage in their life, but certainly it's a possibility. Another possibility, perhaps a little more reasonable, is that maybe you'll spend 5, 6, 7 months. Now, remember, Medicare will pay for some period of time, often up to 100 days, but you have to meet a number of criteria, among which is going directly from the hospital there. It has to be in the nature of treatment. It has to be something other than simply custodial care, which is typically what long-term care is, but it has to be something such as custodial care. But for those people, I mean, virtually everyone over 65 now, I hope, is qualifying and taking advantage of Medicare. So Medicare, unless it's changed dramatically after this next round of elections, I think that can provide a significant amount of coverage. Some people will only be in the hospital perhaps for 100 days. In terms of long-term care. Some, maybe they'll end up at the 2.9, maybe they'll spill over a little bit. Maybe they will spill over a lot. Maybe they'll be 5 or 6 years. I'm simply pointing out that there is a bit of a wager, and the wager is inescapable because it represents the future, and we have to make decisions today, and we simply don't know the future, so we speculate. But an assumption of risk in which you bet the house on everything, it really is an unnecessary gamble on the quality of your life, because that's what we're talking about here, is the quality of your life is what's on the table. And to some extent, the quality of life of your loved ones. It obviously impacts a spouse, but it impacts your children and others, you know, the sort of expenses and costs that you might accumulate and the demands that makes on your estate, the things for which you've worked your entire life. But some people do. They decide to self-insure. And I'm not saying that is necessarily a bad idea. People who have the money and know they'll have the liquidity to do that should that time arise, and they can deal with the possibility that they'll be north of the 2.9 average, Okay, I understand that. And I know a number of people that that's exactly what they do because they can afford it. The average person, people in the middle class, usually cannot. So they look for alternatives such as the long-term care insurance. They may, for example, decide that they want to qualify for Medicaid. Medicaid is something that I'm sure many of you have heard about, the fact that it is very conceivable that people who do have some assets can still strategize in a way that they qualify for long-term care. Middle-class people, many of them, can obtain Medicaid coverage for their period of time in a nursing home, however long that is, if they take certain steps. Now, not everyone, but many. And so lawyers, Cordell Planning Partners and others, lawyers routinely focus on this area of the law, if they're elder lawyers at least. Elder law kind of interestingly came about to some extent as a as an area to address these types of concerns that develop during the lives of people in the latter stages. For example, estate planning, many of us know, there is a focus on meeting some of your needs as you age. But for the most part, when you go to an estate planning lawyer, what do you go there to talk about? You go there to talk about estate planning, a will, a trust, things that are intended to kick in and benefit not you, but the ones you love. As important as that is, it doesn't meet those critical needs that develop in the last third of our lives while we're alive, while we are facing issues such as incapacity and we need to have surrogate decision makers of some sort. There needs to be a device such as a durable power of attorney or a trustee of a trust. There needs to be somebody who is prepared to pick up things and carry them forward on your behalf to the extent you can't while you're alive. That person might be your spouse. It might be that both you and your spouse need someone, a third party, to make these decisions. These are things that commonly develop in the latter stages of our lives. And elder law came along recognizing that this, along with worries about long-term care, require lawyers who have a different perspective, a different focus, because these areas are complicated. I mean, doing Medicaid planning is a complicated area of the law, I can tell you. And it people who do well there often focus on that area of the law. So it is a little different from estate planning, though there is a lot of overlap between estate planners and elder lawyers. But elder lawyers are often somebody in that field should be who you should talk to if you're thinking about how do I meet these long-term care needs that I have. And if you decide that you want to rely on Medicaid, I'll give you a heads up that it does mean that you're going to have to be prepared to make some concessions in terms of control. You know, yeah, that saying that nothing in life is truly free, and when something purports to be, you should be suspicious. I don't think that that's the quote, but it's a paraphrase. In any case, you get it. The idea is that if you're going to protect your assets, and let's assume you have $1 million, $600,000 to $1 million is not uncommon for clients to have that potentially, and they are determined to protect those assets. Generally, with enough foresight, that can be done. Many of you are familiar with the fact that there's a five-year look back, and that when you're doing Medicaid planning, in other words, planning to protect your assets so that you qualify for Medicaid and still have something available for your loved ones when you pass, that is often going to require you to make some concessions in control. And that might mean that, for example, you create a common tool is an irrevocable trust. Well, some of you may be thinking, well, Jay, wait, if there's a five-year look back and I'm in comparatively good health today, or at least I think I can go 5 years before I have to make any application for long-term care, why wouldn't I just give my stuff away? Isn't that simpler to just go ahead and give it to the people I love? I won't say without exception that that is a bad idea, but I would say it's a bad idea with few exceptions. And by that, I mean that the fact is when you put assets in other people's hands, they're vulnerable to a lot of bad stuff. Suddenly, anything that goes wrong or sideways in their life is a problem for the assets that you've given them. So let's assume that you give the assets to someone, a family member. You certainly have given up control. As a matter of fact, you've probably given up more control than if you had given them to an irrevocable trust with an independent trustee. If that person has bankruptcy problems, if they have a lawsuit, if there's a personal injury suit, an automobile accident, for example, if there's a divorce, I can certainly tell you that those assets in a divorce are going to be the subject of much discussion, and the result is likely to be that it's deemed a marital asset, in which case those assets end up in the hands of someone perhaps that you would have least liked of all the candidates to have ended up with your stuff. So handing assets, and I could go on and on, incidentally, there are tax issues that are involved. It's just, I mean, it's a almost without exception, a bad idea to just give your stuff away to people when you can have a more controlled setting to transfer those assets. And that's what a irrevocable trust is. So maybe some of you who struggled with this concept, what is an irrevocable trust and why is this thing necessary? The bottom line is it's a way for you to have your assets protected. They can be outside your control because it is irrevocable. That's the wonderful word that means that they can't be imputed to you, assuming the trust is correctly created. Meaning, if you transfer the $1 million to an irrevocable trust, you can define the people who get it, the circumstances under which they get it, the controls, the investments. You can determine who's going to be the trustee. You're in a position to make all these decisions on which you can have confidence, you know, will be implemented in the future because you have the legal framework to accomplish that. And at the same time, be able to say when you're making an application for long-term care, for example, or other things, even if you're sued, depending on the state, incidentally, sometimes in a trust that you create yourself, some states limit your credit protection from creditors. But in any case, the point is it's a way to where the assets are not yours anymore and you can qualify for long-term care if it's done properly and still have them in a place where you have some sense of confidence that they're going to go where you want them to go. Now, you can still have certain benefits from those. You can have the income paid out to you from those assets. Income can come in the form of interest on bank accounts, dividends on stocks, maybe interest on bonds. So there are ways in which you can have income paid to you and still not violate that idea that this trust is separate and apart from you and is independent of you, and that's the reason it's called an irrevocable trust. So that's a marvelous tool to plan for long-term care. It's not for everybody. What some people do is they're not comfortable with an arrangement like that, so perhaps they want some of the protections. They'll assume some risk. They might decide, well, okay, I understand that I could lose everything if the long-term care costs ended up being very high, if I spend a long time in a nursing home. So here's what I'm willing to do. I'm willing to take some of my assets, for example, my house, maybe, and set it inside this trust as long as I can continue living there, because that I wouldn't feel. In other words, I would use the house the same way after I did the transfer as I did before, meaning you live in it. So there's no feeling that you've lost control in a meaningful way because you're interacting with the asset in the same way before and after that transaction. So a house is sometimes a popular thing to place in an irrevocable trust. Maybe you decide that, oh, I have certain savings that I want to go ahead and place inside the irrevocable trust and not some other things. So in that way, you know, you've kind of hedged your bets. You've decided there are some things I will know that I know that I know. They're protected, whatever happens, including probably, if arranged correctly and in the state of Missouri, some creditor protection generally, not just as it pertains to long-term care. But then you have some other assets that, yeah, you know you're assuming some risk with those, and you know that if long-term care costs were sufficiently high, you could lose those. You get that. But you can live with that because you know that you've still set aside this segment of your estate that can allow you to sleep well at night. So that sort of compromise is what's right for many people. Now, if somebody is looking at a more urgent situation, maybe somebody has had a diagnosis of Alzheimer's or perhaps something else where they feel that they can look on the horizon with relative certainty that in the not-too-distant future they may need that long-term care. They think they might make it to 5 years, but they're not sure. but they're sufficiently confident that they're going to incur substantial long-term care costs that they don't think twice about the restrictions and limitations of placing assets in an irrevocable trust. When those people come in the office, for them, it's a very short conversation about, you know, the pros and cons, because for them, they know what exists on one side of the scales, and that's that they're going to have, or they're reasonably confident, that they're going to have long-term care costs that will eat up everything they have. So for them to be told, well, you know, you won't have the opportunity to interact and control these assets the way you did when they were outside this irrevocable trust, I mean, their mentality is, yeah, I hear you. Where do I sign? Because in their mind, they regard those assets as essentially gone already. So it's easy to think from that perspective about those restrictions. So those conversations are very different from the person who's, say, 70, 75, and they're healthy, and they're trying to handicap this probability or speculate about the probability that they're going to have these costs in the future and weigh the loss of control, et cetera, on the other hand. So when we think about this planning, we think a lot about long-term care costs, and that's kind of what I've dedicated this segment of the show to. But we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I want to shift gears and focus on what these other foundational elements should be of your life plan for the last third of your life. Back in a moment.
You're listening to Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors, presented by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors, and now attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
We're back with Elder Talk. This is Joe Cordell, flying solo today. Today we're talking about what are those foundational elements of a wonderful plan for the last third of your life. Now, I'm assuming that if you're listening to this show, you're at the threshold or you're in the last third. Those of you who want to sort of listen in, you're welcome to, which I'm impressed with somebody who is thinking in their 40s, for example, with the sort of thoughtful discipline that they're likely to have in their 60s about these issues. But anyway, when we think about the foundational elements, we have to talk about, as we did during the first part of the show, we talked about long-term care. But there are a few other components that are as important. One, of course, is a durable power of attorney. You've heard discussion about this on this show, certainly, but probably on other shows. So I won't go into great detail here, but I'll tell you that this tool is the single, simplest, cheapest way to get the biggest bang for your buck of any sort of estate planning device. What I mean, though, is that imagine how easy you could find yourself in circumstances where you suddenly are no longer capable of managing your affairs. I'm not talking about the sort of slow decline that allows you to go visit a lawyer, to discuss what you should do, to visit with family members, maybe get a few other opinions, then ultimately sign off on something 6 months later. I'm not talking about that sort of leisurely pace. I'm talking about something that's sudden and traumatic. Maybe it's a heart attack. Maybe it's a car accident on your way home today. I mean, it could happen in so many different ways and yet so suddenly. And now, guess who's going to control the things in your life on your behalf? Well, we don't know for sure. And you probably don't know for sure. The fact is that once you are suddenly no longer in a position to make decisions, anything that is in your name, anything that requires your signature, is going to require a judge to bring a gavel down after a hearing declaring that someone else has the ability to sign on your behalf. That's the nature of being an adult, in America at least, in most other countries, meaning that you and only you can sign for things that relate to your legal rights, that relate to your legal responsibilities, that relate to your assets, your debts, and other things. The reality is you are the one, and you take great consolation in this, that you're the one whose signature is required to access your bank account. Now, you may be married, and you may have some accounts that are in joint names. So those, it's true that if you had a heart attack today, you were suddenly incompetent, your wife could access accounts that are joint. But I assure you that there are aspects of your financial and legal life that she doesn't have the authority to access on your behalf. And as to those things, that is why you have a hearing on competency, someone who's appointed as a guardian and conservator. State of Missouri, it's defined in two different roles. You can have two people in you can have one person in each of these roles. So a guardianship is somebody who's appointed by the court to make decisions about your physical care, you know, whether you would continue to have care at a certain facility, whether you should be at home, whether caregivers should be hired, all those things that relate to your care. And then there's another position called a conservator. A conservator really doesn't deal with the issues related to your physical care. Their responsibility is to manage your money. So it's like a financial manager. And this role also is appointed as part of this guardianship conservatorship hearing. So in order for such a person to be appointed and to have the authority to step in after this traumatic event in your life, there has to be a hearing. And you should be appreciative of that, meaning that no one can casually have you declared incompetent. And that's exactly what has to happen for someone to have the authority to act as you, to start signing contracts on your behalf for perhaps medical care, for housing needs, etc. Someone has to have the authority to sign on your behalf and to have that signature backed by your assets and your legal duty and rights, et cetera, for that person to have recourse if you breach. There's a whole cascade of reasons that when you are no longer available to act on your behalf, someone has to have the legal authority to do that. And in the absence of this document that I've called a durable power of attorney, in the absence of that, there is an answer, and it's an answer since time immemorial, or at least going back to probably 14th century England, is that someone goes to a court, in this case the probate court, they go before a judge, there's a hearing, perhaps there's someone appointed as a guardian ad litem, someone whose job it is to go out and go into the community, to go to the hospital, perhaps confirm that you're incompetent. It may not require that. Often there may be doctors testify. Again, it may not require that in a given case, depending on the circumstances. But you can see that this whole proceeding is fraught with opportunity for your money to be spent. And incidentally, you should keep in mind that this is being paid for with your money, for arguments about who should be making this decision. You know, it's funny. Many people talk about how children are prone to fight a lot about such things relating to their parents, both during their parents' end-of-life period as well as after their death. But I can tell you that my experience has been that, yes, they do fight, but less about greedy motives to get more money, although that happens. More it happens after the parents are gone. But I can tell you that when there are those disagreements about the estate while the parents are alive or either of the parents, then more often than not, it really is about children believing that perhaps their sibling is dishonoring or disrespecting or ignoring the wishes or care of their parent. And sometimes this is a good faith disagreement. Sometimes it may be an expression of conflicts that have existed for long before this time. But in any case, that's what I see often as the sort of impetus to these ugly fights, some of which are fought out in a competency hearing in a probate court while their parent may be on a respirator in a hospital after some catastrophic accident or perhaps as a traumatic health event. In any case, the judge will hear this testimony and make a decision as to who will have this authority. And remember, it can be two different people in this role of conservator versus guardian litem, or it could be one person who does both roles. Now, many of us can imagine when we have more than one child that we could think of one child as being really good at one aspect of this and not so good at the other, maybe really good at the nurturing piece and perhaps less good at the financial manager piece and vice versa. So, do you want to have the probate litigation dissipation of estate plan? That's probably the plan you have now in place, incidentally, if you don't have a durable power of attorney. Or do you want to have this piece of paper, maybe several pieces of paper, but the point is it's not a tome, and that called a durable power of attorney, that by your signature, you preempt all of this expense, all of this conflict, all of this delay, and all of this potential course that you personally would not have approved of. In other words, you can assure that the plan you want is in place for you, in addition to avoiding all this bad stuff that I just described. So durable power of attorney, when I say that it's the biggest bang for your planning life in the last third of your life and respecting thereafter, it really is, because you accomplish so much. You put in power somebody who is going to do the things you want to do. You head off sources of conflict and things that might eat away at your estate unnecessarily. And you know that you have planned for something that with each day that passes is a little less improbable. You understand what I mean by that? Is while it may be improbable that it's in the foreseeable future when you're 60, with every year that passes, the probability increases that you will need someone in this role. So it's not something you should blow off. And incidentally, if you're 40 years old, this could happen. We all know, you know examples of times when somebody who thought they had the world by the tail and something happened and suddenly they didn't. And it happened so suddenly that they needed to go to court to have someone empowered to act on their behalf. All right, so this is a key component, durable power of attorney. Related to this, and I'll kind of dispose of this quickly, is the durable power of attorney for health care. As the name implies, it does the same thing, except it's for health care. And that's decisions relating to respirator, relating to even pain medication, the extent to which somebody may be rendered in a stupor, essentially, with pain medication. Some people don't want that in their latter stages. It can mean whether food and nutrition, food and water are essentially discontinued by intravenous feedings, which that is more and more a question when somebody has an illness by which they can linger for years unless that step is taken. People have different opinions about that, and often they're religious in nature. But in any case, these are among the decisions that have to be made as to your final care. You know, what are the circumstances related to your care? What do you want? And if you don't take the trouble to write these things down and to appoint people who you know will carry out that plan, then you just invite a set of circumstances that are not going to be consistent with your desires in all probability. So durable power of attorney for healthcare, I don't need to talk a lot about that, I don't think, to persuade you that this is very important. So let's move on and talk about a trust. A trust I did refer to earlier when I described the irrevocable trust, but let me just talk about these core components and try to do it in a way that makes sense to you without belaboring the point. A trust is a device where you want to place some stuff, some assets, in the hands of a third party to take care of for someone else, for beneficiaries. So you're the settlor, you transfer the assets in the hands of a trustee, but the trustee holds legal title, but not what's called beneficial title. So they have legal title to it, but they have a duty, an obligation legally, it's called a fiduciary duty, a very solemn duty, to use those assets in the way that you have instructed them for the benefit of the beneficiaries that you've identified. So if you think about it, it's not surprising that this thing came along in 14th century England. At the time, it was a tactic more or less to avoid inheritance tax or incidents that were related to the feudal system. And so this was a device that was come up by which people could avoid these death taxes and these additional obligations. And what they did was they often used the church to act as the trustee, and it was placed in the hands of the church, one of the few institutions in which you could have some confidence during that period of time. And then they would use it for the benefit of their designated beneficiaries or heirs, after which, of course, it might revert to the church at the end of their lives. So trust really makes a lot of sense, and it can be used in a lot of different ways. But one of the ways you can use it is to use it as a tool for estate planning so that you accomplish two things. You accomplish some benefits in your lifetime because you can go ahead and have that trustee that you named to be a successor trustee, meaning somebody that only comes in when something happens to you. So this may sound a little confusing, but if it's a revocable trust, not an irrevocable, if it's a revocable trust, it means that it's not unusual for you to be the settlor, meaning you're the person creating it, perhaps you and your wife, and naming yourselves as the trustees. So you're wearing the hat of the settlor, you're wearing the hat of the trustees, and naming yourselves as the beneficiaries. You're wearing that hat too. And you may think, well, that sounds silly. Well, you're doing that to put everything in place for when some event might occur that requires a change in the trustee, especially, and that when that happens, you already have in place the structure and the rules that you want by which your stuff is handled. See, even if you have, for example, an event where you become incompetent, you and your wife, let's assume, immediately became incompetent, you're both still alive. So though both of you may be named as trustees, you've named successor trustees. You get to prepare a list. Okay, I'm number one as long as I can. When I can't, when both of us can't, or my wife may be number two. When both of us can't, then I name number three. When that person can't, I'm going to name number four. So you've covered a lot of possibilities. And then you can do the same thing with beneficiaries. And that's what's really cool about it, is you start out naming yourselves as the beneficiaries because, I mean, you want your assets used for you while you're alive, probably. So you name yourselves as number one in the line of beneficiaries. But just like you did with trustees, you name a number two and a number three and a number four. So after you and your wife, after the last of you dies, you probably put your children on the same line saying, after we're gone, then I want child A, B, and C to share equally. And then when they die, I want their children to share equally. Or if one of them has died, I want that share to be enjoyed by that person's children, meaning your grandkids. That's not an uncommon arrangement. And what's really cool about this is it happens without the involvement of any court. As trustees die or quit, as beneficiaries die, then these relegations of responsibility happen automatically. There's not a court involved. They're not lawyers. You're not having hearings and testimony and expenses and delay. I mean, the sort of cost associated with probate, I won't go into that here, but it's not necessary. You can avoid that. And you have privacy and confidentiality that you don't have with the probate process. So it's a marvelous tool to get a lot done, not only inexpensively, but in a way that is more likely to be what you wanted without the hassles. So think about a trust. You shouldn't think that you need to be rich to have a trust. A trust makes sense, I argue, for almost everybody. And I guess if you have few enough assets, maybe there's an exception. But I'm just a big fan of trust. There's not that much additional more cost than a will. And it provides additional benefits that, of course, a will can't do. So think about this. As I describe this plan, think about who you would have in each role. Now, what about trustees? I'm willing to bet that you're going to want to start out being your own trustee, meaning you're running everything for yourself. Here's what's cool also about a benefit from this. What if you do have an incident occur, such as we've been describing, where you become incompetent? In this case, do you need to go to court? Do you have to have somebody appointed as a guardian respecting the estate, or a conservator rather, especially, someone to manage the assets? No, you don't, because you have somebody to do that. Remember, the reason you went to court was because you didn't have anybody who could legally step into your shoes and sign documents and commit you to contracts and do other things on your behalf. If you have a trustee and a trust in which you placed your assets and you've given the trustee this authority in the event you become incompetent, then guess what happens automatically according to the terms of your trust if you become incompetent? Automatically, there's someone who's stepping into your shoes legally without a gavel going down in a court. Remember, that was the necessity? Now you have an alternative to that. So this is one of the benefits which is additional to the benefits of avoiding probate, of being able to literally transfer these assets, at the risk of sounding morbid, within hours of the death of the last of you or your wife, for example, or you or your husband. In other words, there aren't the administrative delays, there aren't the expenses, all those things we associate. I don't want to beat that in the ground, but I want you to really understand how smoothly things go when the baton is passed inside a trust versus when there is no trust. I want you to get how simple and smooth things can happen. So now this is revocable, which means if you've created a plan, you don't like it in some way. I mean, you're in charge of it, as the term implies. You can throw it out. You can abolish it. You can do what you want with it. But when you do create the trust, you do need to put your assets in it. And I can't tell you how many times I've seen cases where somebody would come in and their lawyer had prepared this beautiful trust. I mean, it is imagine an automobile that's this beautiful design, beautiful feature. It would have accomplished goals. Great device. Maybe they paid several thousand dollars potentially for a trust of that nature. And guess what? There are no passengers. In other words, there's no one in it. So you have this great trust that has no effect on anything because it doesn't contain assets. If you create a trust and you have real estate, you have bank accounts, you have all this stuff sitting outside your trust, you don't change the title. You fail to change the title, for example, on your bank account. You fail to create new deeds, for example, putting them inside this trust. Then as wonderful as the trust might have been, it's of no value because you don't have assets in it. It's really it's an error that I can't tell you how common it is. And lawyers will often prepare a beautiful trust thinking they've done what they need to do. And in fairness to the lawyers, you know, they will, I'll assume, tell their clients they've got to put stuff in it. They have to go make the transfer. It's called funding the trust. But it really just means putting your stuff in it that you want the trust to control. Because if it's not in the trust, then everything I've told you that a trust does doesn't matter because it doesn't have any authority over it. I hope I haven't bored you with this discussion, but I really want you to understand the fundamentals of a trust and how cool it is and how beneficial it can be. Looks like I'm about out of time here. So I guess I would wrap up by adding this other point. Another element is a will. I don't spend a lot of time with wills because if you have a trust, the will's purpose is simply to act as a safety net. So you have, it's often called a pour-over will, but as the name implies, it's a net. Imagine a net below your trust so that if there's something you didn't put in your trust, you just didn't get around to changing the title on a bank account, well, it's not a disaster. Now, it does go, we'll assume, into the estate or into probate. So it does have to be dealt with according to the rules we talked about earlier in the show. But the good news is, once the gavel goes down, it does end up in the trust, so it ends up under being governed and managed under the same rules. So it's not a complete disaster. But the whole idea is you don't want to plan for stuff to have to fall into your will. If you have everything in your trust, then you can expect that net below it, we'll call the will you have as a backup, will not ever come into play because there won't be anything that ends up going into your estate because it's in your trust, and the things in your trust do not go into your estate. They continue on being managed by this entity, this thing called your trust, over whom the trustee is in charge. And why does he manage those things? He manages them for the beneficiaries that you've designated. And you might have several generations of those. Okay, time has flown. I've enjoyed this discussion. I hope it's been beneficial to you. Till next time, another episode of Elder Talk. Take care.
You've been listening to Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, sponsored by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. For more information, visit eldercarelaw.com. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.